Well, welcome to the final event of C.S. Lewis Week, which is a lecture by Rory Scheiner called The Possibility of Conversion in an Age of Skepticism, C.S. Lewis's Move from Atheism to Christianity. Rory was born in Albany in Western Australia and is currently the minister at St. Matthew's Uni Church in Subiaco. He studied English and anthropology at UWA before studying theology in Sydney. He is currently completing a PhD through the Ancient History Department of Macquarie University on the scholarship and biography of the Australian scholar and church leader Donald Robinson. So let's welcome up in the normal fashion. Hi, Rory.
Hi. Hi, Kim.
So I guess the typical question is, are you a fan of C.S. Lewis on a scale of like 1, which is like, yeah, he's okay, to like 10, he's like amazing?
Yeah, I'd 8.5, I think, as in I... like, funnily enough, so C.S. Lewis is a Christian and I'm a Christian, and there'd be a number of places where we differ on some specifics of Christianity and the place of Mary and the various things where we'd be different, and if we had a debate, he'd win every single one of them. But and so sometimes in terms of formal agreement, we're not always close. But I think for someone who captured what it feels like to be a Christian, was able to use imagination and intuition and reason to give you in Aslan or in mere Christianity or in that hideous strength, and you would say, yes, that's what it feels like. I think there's no one I've ever come across who gets it as right as he does.
Yeah. Okay. So C.S. Lewis Week is kind of like celebrating or like the anniversary of C.S. Lewis's death, which is 50 years ago. What relevance does he have like right now in 2013?
Well, so interesting thing, C.S. Lewis claimed, although maybe he was being coy, but he claimed that he thought that the memory of his writing and work would be gone within about 5 years of his death. And the interesting thing is that that hasn't happened, and in fact he has massively ascended in his popularity and the buying and reading of his work and stuff. And I think, again, which tracks back to what I said earlier, his arguments for Christianity, I think, are pretty good, and but there's you can find fault with them, and there might be people here who could help us to find fault with them. His medieval and Renaissance literature is excellent, but not my field. But again, I think his capacity to get you inside and to sneak up on you, because you might have preconceptions about who Jesus is and what God is like, but to talk about Aslan and the great emperor from beyond the sea and so on, I think it helps to get under our preconceptions to think these things again. So I think he continues to be really important, especially at that level of a public Christian who addresses our imagination.
Okay. So you're talking about C.S. Lewis's life and how he moved from atheism to Christianity. I guess, why is that important? I guess, what do you want to, like, what are your hopes and goals for this kind of talk?
Cool. I don't want to give anything away. I think I'll argue for the hopes and goals in the first bit. So in addition to what I say the hopes and goals are, I hope that we have a really good time together. And I'm really looking forward to the question time and maybe chats afterwards. About this person that I'm a big fan of. Right. An 8.5 fan.
Take it away.
Well, tonight's lecture is about the possibility of conversion in an age of scepticism. The conversion in question is that of C.S. Lewis. The age that I have in mind is the world of England, and particularly southern England, between the wars. And the scepticism is specifically the scepticism of logical positivism, or the Oxford realism, or what C.S. Lewis called the new look. That is to say, in tonight's lecture, we're travelling back in time and across the globe to a situation in very many ways very different from our own. Only 80 years ago, and yet it's a world in which women did not vote or had limited voting rights. and were unable to be full students at Oxford or Cambridge or on the faculty 80 years ago. It was a world in which the British Empire, the words the British Empire swirled chests with a sense of pride rather than had people recoil in horror, of course, depending on which side of the British Empire you were on. And it was a world in which smoking was just uber cool. You know that if you've read Narnia, you can always tell if there's a bad or morally suspect character because Lewis will tell you this person does not smoke. That was only 80 years ago, a very different world from our own. But of course, I take it that most of us, or none of us perhaps, come or give public lectures for merely antiquarian interest. And I guess for most of us, we're here because we have some interest for some reason in the figure of C.S. Lewis, that in some way his writings, whether his Narnia Chronicles, his science fiction, his apologetic writing, his scholarship has somehow reached out and grabbed us in a way that we connect with him and the things that he said. But I think, as we said before, the figure of C.S. Lewis still matters today because for all the distance between us, there are some impressive connections between Lewis's world and our own. Lewis lived in a world of scepticism, and I think it's fair to say, at least since the early 2000s, that our age is characterised too as an age of scepticism. In my judgment, there was a different kind of scepticism that reigned from the 1970s until the late 1990s, a scepticism that saw religious truth claims as power plays, and in fact saw all truth claims as power plays, as attempts to frame the victim and the passive and the other in ways that serve the interests of power. But particularly since September 11 and in the last decade or so, New Atheism has revived a kind of specific religious scepticism that sees religious truth claims as not just power plays, but false, claiming things that are not the case. And in that way, 80 years on, I think the scepticism that is part of our world is very like the new look or the logical positivism that Lewis was grappling with in his time at Oxford. And these views, the reason that C.S. Lewis matters, the reason it's worth thinking about these things, is not only because they have deep affinities in terms of the way our intellectual world works, but actually institutional connections. Both the world of C.S. Lewis and his circle, J.R. Tolkien, is the same world that Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens and Daniel Dennett share in common. That is, Oxford. Or put it this way, what do C.S. Lewis, J.R. Tolkien, Christopher Hitchens, Daniel Dennett, Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett have in common? They went to the same university. Graduates of the one place existed in their undergraduate, in some cases postgraduate and teaching careers, within like a 1 square mile of each other. And in some ways, the debate between atheists and Christians, framed in the way that it is here, is really kind of a senior common room debate between people who are only 1 degree of separation from each other. We live in an age of scepticism, and as such, I think we are fascinated by, or repelled by, or at least intrigued by, it's my final reason why it matters to think about C.S. Lewis, intrigued by the figure of the convert. Now, I realise we all know the convert in their less attractive guise, you know, the person who has recently discovered Noam Chomsky, or Calvinism, or the paleo diet, or interval training, or atheism, or born-again Christianity, or cloth nappies, you know, that person, because they want you to know it as well, and at best they're endearing and well-meaning, at their worst aggressive and insensitive and tedious. We know that guy. But the good news is that that person often moves on and either moves to their next fad or settles down into a more mature approach to their topic and the conversation can begin. But I'm talking about the convert in another sense, that the convert that converts rationally in adulthood, seemingly not under compulsion. And I think that figure, the convert, in that sense, is both a threat and a possibility for all of us. Because the convert has, in some major sense, abandoned their previous position and opted for its alternative. That person, as their best, hold up the possibility of another world, like one of the portals to Narnia, like the big empty wardrobe, the big wardrobe in the empty room, or like the door in the last battle. The convert opens up a possibility of another way of seeing the world, of a possibility that things are not as we see them, that there's more, that there's something that we've missed. Just as they're a threat, because the convert in their very presence suggests to us, whether they mean to or not, that we might be wrong, that we might have missed something, that we might need to look again. And so it's tempting, I think, for any of us to construct the convert, to put a narrative around the convert in a way that protects us in our own position. So the Christian, for example, who sees a once fellow Christian emerge as a strident atheist will be tempted to construct a narrative around that convert to say, well, they never really were Christian, or that they've just been tempted by the world, the flesh and the devil, or it's just a phase they're going through and they'll one day return. Just as the atheist will be tempted to see their once atheist and now Christian friend as someone who's been brainwashed or confused or went to a Jesuit school and it's kind of come back to haunt them or something. Now, I'm not saying that any of those narratives or any of those descriptions are not true. It may well be true that it's just a phase. It may well be true that they're being tempted by the world, the flesh, and the devil. Those could be true. I'm just saying that as well as possibly being true, they are kind of narratives that we construct to protect ourselves from the kind of threatening presence of the convert, the one who offers to us the possibility that there's something else and the threat that maybe we're wrong. And I wanted tonight, in the time that we have, to think about C.S. Lewis as the convert in that sense. And so with that, on to one of the more famous converts in intellectual history. As many of you will have gathered, on the 22nd of November, that is exactly 50 years ago this year, on the same day that John F. Kennedy was assassinated, the man once described by an enemy as the best read man in England, Clive Staples Lewis, died. He was fluent in Latin, Greek, Norse, Old and Middle English, French and German, vastly well read in ancient, medieval and Renaissance literature. His books, such as The Preface to Paradise Lost, The Allegory of Love, The Abolition of Man, Introduction to 16th Century English Literature, excluding drama, have their place as some of the most important contributions to literary scholarship in the 20th century. Just as his children's series, The Chronicles of Narnia, his science fiction have secured their place in thousands of children and adult hearts. And his apologetic writing continues to command the attention of sceptics and Christians alike. But of course, our topic tonight is not Lewis's canon, his literature, but his conversion from atheism to Christianity. Lewis had been an atheist since high school. He'd gone through his undergraduate career at Oxford and was into his 30s before he made his dramatic move from atheism to the Christian faith. Why did he do it? What led him in that direction? Why was he prepared to wear some significant cost to his academic career and his reputation among his colleagues? What compelled him on that path? That's the story I want to tell in the time that remains. C.S. Lewis was born, my notes say, in 1998, but I think that's incorrect. In 1898, into a well-to-do and fairly conventional Northern Irish Protestant home. Outside of the when they were physically outside of the physical home, Lewis and his brother Warney were able to kind of roam free in the lush green hills that surround Belfast, and their imagination roamed with them as they invented lands. Warney's land was called India. There was also another country called India, but he called his land India. And Lewis had a land called Animal Land, and together they became Boxen. and were places where their imaginations were fueled. And when the weather or illness prevented outside adventure, which in Ireland is a lot, their house was full of books. A house full of books, and Lewis, those books became Lewis's constant companions. As a child, Lewis writes about his childhood in Surprised by Joy, and he recalls, he writes that as a Christian looking back and trying to trace the path that we're tracing tonight. He recalls three events that would later shape his return to God and his path back to Christianity. They're kind of idiosyncratic, but worth hearing for the big picture. The first one, Lewis describes it as a memory of a memory, which is he was about six or seven, and he stood beside a flowering currant bush, and the smell of the flowers suddenly transported him to the previous home that they've lived in. That's probably a common experience. Smell has a capacity, has some relationship to memory, and in that particular instance, it transported him back to his previous house. But of that seemingly kind of trivial event, Lewis says this in Surprised by Joy: "It's difficult to find words strong enough for the sensation that came over me. A sensation, of course, of desire, but desire for what? And before I knew it, the desire itself was gone, only stirred by a longing for the longing that had just ceased. It had only taken a moment of time, and in a certain sense, everything else that ever happened was insignificant in comparison." His first childhood experience. The second one was obscurely enough for an Oxford Don, reading the fairy tales of Beatrix Potter, and in particular one called Squirrel Nutkin, which you may be familiar with. The story of Squirrel Nutkin sparked in him an intense longing for something that he described as the idea, capital I, the idea of autumn. And for him, he was just struck by the way this story transported him into the idea of autumn and a desire for the idea of autumn. The third was read in a line of poetry from a Scandinavian saga, where he was arrested by these words, which I think have an arresting quality for some reason. Have a listen. In the Scandinavian saga, "I heard a voice that cried, 'Balder the beautiful is dead, is dead.'" In Alistair McGrath's description, he says this, the biographer: "Lewis found the impact of these words devastating. It was as if they opened up a door that he did not know existed, allowing him to see a realm beyond his own." Or in Lewis's own words, he says, "I knew nothing of Balder, but instantly I was uplifted into this huge region of northern sky, and I desired with almost sickening intensity something never to be described, except that it is cold, spacious, severe, pale, and remote. And then, as the other examples, found myself in the very same moment already falling out of the desire and wishing I were back in it." These, for Lewis, were the seed of something that he later gave the technical name joy, a longing that transcends any possessing, a sense that there is something that you want and the very wanting of it is better than the possession of anything in this world. Now, on the other side of joy, which Lewis was starting to trace in his own heart and experience, was also suffering. Subsequently, a major stumbling block for Lewis's acceptance of Christianity. And for Lewis, there were three main sources of suffering: death, war, and school. Firstly, death. Lewis's idyllic and almost certainly romanticised childhood was about to receive its first devastating blow. On the 23rd of August 1908, with Lewis, aged 10, in their home, Lewis's beloved mother Flora died of abdominal cancer. It was a death that Lewis saw up close in a way that is kind of foreign to the way we do death. The Edwardian custom was to die in the home and to have the children view the body. And not a body made pristine, a body which bore the horrible marks of the way of her death. Lewis saw the body of his mother as a 10-year-old and he was deeply traumatised. And I quote, "With my mother's death, all settled happiness and all that was tranquil and reliable disappeared from my life." The death of his mother was met by a disastrous decision on the part of his father to send the 10-year-old immediately off to boarding school in England. It was a relationship with his father that never recovered, and a great source of guilt to Lewis himself afterwards at his shabby treatment in his estimation of his father at his father's death. But they had no real relationship from that point on as a 10-year-old son. He was sent to school, and in something that has baffled Lewis's biographers ever since, for Lewis, the horrors of the English school system take up a disproportionate amount of verbiage in his biography. He went to the war, and the war seems to have paled in comparison to the horrors of school. As I say, a terrible decision on the part of his father to send a grieving 10-year-old to school. And if you know Lewis's literature, you'll recall, as you think about it, that almost every reference to a school or a school teacher is negative, including if you're at the lecture on Monday, reminded that the senior devil in the Screwtape Letters was a school kind of teacher. That obviously grabbed his own biography, where as you'll be aware, the bullying and the institutionalised school-sanctioned system of sexual and physical abuse from older to younger children in the fagging system horrified and traumatised the young Lewis. And finally, the experience of war. In late 1916, Lewis gained admission to Oxford, but as the date suggests, the war intervened. And in November 1917, Lewis was deployed to France. He faced the trenches and was wounded, so his was a short but real experience of the Great War. He talks, actually, he talks very little about the war. God, skip for a moment. There was a point where he kind of started to position himself as a war poet, and he was an unsuccessful poet in general and an unsuccessful war poet in particular. Although, listen to these words. In prose, he talks about, in The Surprise by Joy, the horribly smashed men still moving like half-crushed beetles, the sitting or standing corpses, the landscape of sheer earth without a blade of grass. It's extraordinary to me that someone who could write that sentence could not become a war poet, and it seems that Lewis really coped by partitioning off that part of his life. And in what he talked about, a truce with reality, part of his truce with reality was to frame out the war and almost never talk about it in his writing and so on. At any rate, those experiences, as you can imagine, by the time he got to Oxford, the specific claim of Christians that the God, the Creator God, is a good God, was fatally undermined by the reality of suffering and evil. Now, there is one final ingredient in understanding, or cog in the wheel of understanding Lewis's childhood, where he had a brief reprieve from the unmitigated horror of the English boarding school system, where in the years 1914 to 1917, his father, thankfully, took him out of school and put him under the private tutoring of a man called Kirkpatrick, or as the family called him, for reasons I know not why, the Great Knock. And the Great Knock, so this is Lewis in what would be for us late high school. He has these several years of private tuition, not being in a school, but being one-on-one with this man who was his tutor, who tutored him toward his Oxford exams. He lived in Bookham in Surrey, so again, we're out of Ireland and into England. And in Surprise by Joy, Lewis describes his first meeting of the Great Knock of Kirk. Lewis gets out of the thing, say 17, 16, 15, like a 15-year-old, and in terms of trying to make awkward small talk, he gets off the train, meets Kirk, and kind of says, looks at the scenery and says, "The scenery in Surrey is a bit more wild than I had expected. Stop, said Kirk, with a suddenness, I'm quoting, that made me jump. What do you mean by wildness, and what grounds had you for not expecting it? Lewis kind of fumbled out some answers that were subsequently torn to shreds. And again, I quote, a few passes suffice to show that I had no clear and distinct idea corresponding to the word wildness, and that, insofar as I had any idea at all, wildness was a singularly inept word. Do you not see, concluded the great Nock, that your remark was meaningless? And the 15-year-old Lewis expects him to drop it at that point. But the Kirk went on, quoting again, on what basis had my expectations about the flora and on what had I based my expectations about the flora and geology of Surrey? Was it maps or photos or books? I could produce none. It had, heaven help me, never occurred to me that what I called my thoughts needed to be based on anything. Kirk drew one more conclusion without the slightest sign of emotion, but equally without the slightest concession to what I thought good manners. Do you not see, then, that you have no right to any opinion whatever on the subject? Lewis said, if ever a man that came near to being a purely logical entity, that man was Kirk. Born a little later, he would have been a logical positivist. And Lewis loved it. He describes in his biography as the strong meat that he never got at school, that he craved and that he loved. He talks about other children may have been crushed under the circumstances, but he rose to it. But importantly for our narrative tonight, Kirk was also an atheist of the logical positivist kind of school. Again, in Surprised by Joy, Lewis notes that the only non-logical thing he ever spotted in Kirk's life was that on Sundays he stayed home from church in a slightly better suit. He says, quote again, an Ulster Scot may come to disbelieve in God, but never to wear his weekday clothes on the Sabbath. Now, just to be clear in our story, Lewis was already an atheist by the time he arrived to study with Kirk. And in fact, Lewis had, without any evidence at all of regret or sadness or mourning, you know, unlike Matthew Arnold and others, had no sadness about abandoning the rather conventional Christianity in which he'd been brought up. Lewis was steeped in the mythologies of Greece and Rome and the sagas of Northern Europe and made the simple and obvious conclusion that all religions are mythologies invented by human beings, usually in response to their own emotional needs. It's an argument you'll recognise from Feuerbach or Freud, but it goes back much further, namely that religions are human inventions. They are us projected onto the sky. Instead of God making us in his image, we have made God in our image. And if horses had gods, they'd probably look a bit like horses. It's an interesting case against God, because it's the kind of case that would seem compelling in a multicultural society like our own, that if you sit on the bus and you've got a God that has some affinities with what you're like, and the person next to you has a God that looks a bit like them, then an obvious conclusion is that both of you have made it up, and that seems more apparent than that God looked like you to you and looked like him to him. For Lewis, who was raised in a decidedly monocultural context, it wasn't the multiculturalism around him, but the multiculturalism of his reading, of being so deeply grounded in pagan literature. That, for Lewis, invited the comparison between the God of his ancestors and all the other gods, and he concluded that his mythology deserved no special pass over the others. At any rate, Kirk did not establish him in his atheism, but gave Lewis a powerful and satisfying way of thinking and seeing the world that framed his atheism and made it satisfying. By the time before Lewis had arrived at Oxford, he concluded that the rational case for faith was without any merit and could be entertained by no educated adult unless they were idiots, brainwashed, or completely unreflective. And yet, at the same time, Lewis had, as we saw from his childhood and subsequent experience, this intense sense of joy, of longing, this thing that was often triggered by imaginative literature and aesthetic experience and so on, this thing, this desire that was better than any possession. After the war, Lewis returned and had a distinguished career as an undergraduate at Oxford as a settled and secure atheist. For him, it was as obvious that the Christian God didn't exist as it was that Zeus or Hermes or Thor did not exist. But it was here at Oxford that over many years his atheism began to get unstuck. How did it happen? How did this apparently watertight case against the God, the Christian God, come unstuck for Lewis? Well, there's kind of a story, there's important developments. Firstly, Lewis developed some very important friendships as an undergraduate at Oxford. One was with Owen Barfield, who was an Anglican poet. And Lewis, in his biography, credits Owen with dislodging a couple of things for him that were paths to God. The first is what Lewis came to call chronological snobbery, the idea that the latest is therefore the best. Barfield disavowed him of that position, and ever since, however that happened, ever since Lewis almost went the opposite direction to be deeply suspicious of the most current ideas. But the second that was dislodged for him in this series of friends was the assumption that the universe, as revealed by the senses, was rock-bottom reality. For Lewis, the world, as known by the senses, that is a purely kind of scientific view of reality, was a view that was found wanting. He asked, what about moral judgments? What about the experience of joy? What about transcendence and beauty? What about rationality or the logos, as it's called in Plato, itself? For Lewis, these things began to get dislodged through these friendships. It increasingly seemed to Lewis that the positivism that he had accepted appeared to him to be self-defeating. On what basis do we make these rational judgments? From where does rationality come? Why should we think that our senses or our thoughts are reliable? Now, of course, as you will immediately recognise, that does not necessarily open you up to the Christian position or the Christian understanding. Platonism, for example, is a very good contender for someone who's become dissatisfied with those things. But they are the things that dislodged Lewis, and by 1929 he began to actively believe in God. Now, it's worth stepping out of C.S. Lewis's story for a moment to think about that in the context of the wider story, I guess, of Western culture and so on. Western culture, you probably have noticed this, as seeing a fairly significant move away from the Christian faith and from church attendance and so on in the last 50 years. How do you account for that? Some people like Charles Taylor or Pope Benedict or John Milbank have long intellectual stories about what happened in the 1600s or the 1300s or even before, and the way that certain intellectual trends have played out in our culture. On the other hand, sociologists like Callum Brown argue for a far more recent departure of the West from its ancestral religion, arguing that the rise of feminism and sometimes even cars in the 1960s made it possible. For Peter Hitchens, Christopher's brother, it was the war itself and the failure of the churches to distance themselves from the Great War and allow the flags of empire into the houses of worship. My observation is that among the new atheists of Dawkins and so on, the almost taken for granted assumption is that it really begins to get unravelled at the time of Darwin and the rise of the theory of evolution and so on, as the kind of critical moment where before that atheism was plausible, but after Darwin, as Dawkins says, it became intellectually satisfying. Anyway, whatever the case, at this time, certainly the seeds of some sort of rejection of the Christian faith are sown. People like the Bloomsbury Group, Virginia Woolf and Ian Foster, all rejected the faith of their parents and pursued a post-Christian future. And we had, kind of for the first time in ages in the West, a genuinely kind of post-Christian literature in the work of those groups, as Bertrand Russell at Cambridge argued for the irrationality of belief in God. But there's another story there that is perhaps less well known, where figures like G.K. Chesterton, Graham Greene, Evelyn Waugh, and T.S. Eliot all underwent profound conversions to Christianity. And the interesting connection that biographers note is that these figures, Eliot and Waugh and Chesterton and Graham Greene, became Christians through their literary work. It was through their attempts to write fiction that they found themselves in the Christian faith. Waugh, for example, Evelyn Waugh said that Christianity provided a profound account of human nature and the significance of human action, and brought the distorted world around him into sharp focus. And I think Lewis, if you try to understand his conversion, fits within that camp of literary conversions, of people who in their engagement with fiction came to faith in Christ. In Surprised by Joy, Lewis says this: "A young man who wishes to remain a sound atheist cannot be too careful of his reading. There are traps everywhere." For Lewis, he discovered in 1927, 28, 29 that he needed something bigger than atheism, bigger than naturalism, bigger than materialism to make his treaty with reality make sense. He existed in what he says was a ludicrous contradiction between my theory of life and my actual experience as a reader. Lewis's actual conversion, now we get the point of his actual conversion, is probably deeply frustrating for Christians who are wedded to a theory of conversion where it must be instantaneous, normally in a church service, normally with dimmed lights and someone calling you down the front. Because for Lewis, it takes, as you can tell, ages. And it's kind of a stumbling and faltering path. He describes it not like a young person at a Christian kind of rock concert walking forward, but as a chess game in which the divine continues to make moves that eventually hem him in to checkmate. Lewis describes his conversion as kind of like a scientist who saw all these disconnected clues and one day wakes up at 3 o'clock in the morning and suddenly discovers a way of seeing them that accounts for the whole. Lewis describes it in these terms: "On one side, a many-islanded sea of poetry and myth. On the other, a glib and shallow rationalism. Nearly all that I loved, I believed to be imaginary. Nearly all that I believed to be real, I thought grim and meaningless." On the night of Saturday, the 19th of September, 1931, Lewis's friend J.R.R. Tolkien talked with Lewis until about 3 a.m. In that conversation, Tolkien shared with Lewis his opinion that for him, as Tolkien obviously a Christian, that for him the Christian story was the true myth. That's how Tolkien understood it. Tolkien, also deeply immersed in pagan myth, understood that Christianity not only opposed the pagan myths, which in a sense it did, but also fulfilled their best instincts, their best longings. That what was pointed to in the stories of Greece and Rome and in the pagan mythologies found its proper fulfilment in the true myth, in the myth that is grounded in the actual soil and history and reality of first century Palestine. For Lewis, that way of relating mythology to Christianity opened up a possibility that not just God, but Christianity itself might be true. And he saw in that a way of reconciling his powerful imagination with his powerful rationality to bring those together into an integrated whole. Now, we're doing our time, but I can't resist reading to you the account of his conversion proper. Lewis says this: "Doubtless, by definition, God was reason itself. But would he also be reasonable in that other, more comfortable sense?" You can hear Aslan in there, the not tame lion. "Not the slightest," or read that again, "but would he also be reasonable in the other, more comfortable sense? Not the slightest assurance on that score was offered me. Total surrender. The absolute leap in the dark were demanded. The reality with which no treaty can be made was upon me. The demand was not simply all or nothing. It was just all." He says, "You must picture me alone in that room in Magdalen, night after night, feeling whenever my mind lifted even for a second from my work, the steady, unrelenting approach of him who I so earnestly desired not to meet. That which I had greatly feared had at last come upon me. In the Trinity term, I gave in and admitted that God was God, and knelt and prayed, perhaps that night, the most dejected and reluctant convert in all England." He says, "The prodigal son at least walked home on his own feet, but who can duly adore the love which will open the high gates to a prodigal who is brought in kicking, struggling, resentful, and darting his eyes in every direction for a chance of escape?" Also, somewhat obscurely and disappointingly, if you want things to be easy to follow, that was his conversion to God in the abstract. His conversion to Christ in particular as the incarnate Son of God came on a ride to a zoo. And all he can remember is that when he got into the car or the trolley, he didn't believe that Jesus was the Son of God, and by the time he got to the zoo, he did. So apart from recommending more trips to the zoo, let me try and bring this together. A couple of things. Firstly, I guess I want to say, and to put it out there, Lewis, in his conversion at least, experienced no sense that becoming a Christian meant abandoning his rationality, his empiricism, or his logic. In fact, in Lewis's particular case, which is repeated many times, the problem with rationalism and with empiricism was the problem with faith was not that it contracted, but that his problem in atheism was not that it was too big and grand and scary, but it was too small. That it accounted so well for that for which it accounted, but it did not account for enough. It did not, in wanting to be rational, he said that he lost reason itself. In wanting to understand the world on purely natural terms, he saw that he lost the mind and the security of the mind that can look at the world and trust that it can be known. The logical positivism against which he eventually defined himself was based, for example, on the idea that every truth claim must be falsifiable. But how is that claim itself falsified? Lewis understood his conversion to Christianity not as finding one bit of evidence that moved him in the right direction, but rather, as he describes it, we know the existence of the sun not just by seeing the sun, but by seeing all things by the light of the sun. And for Lewis, the classical theism, and eventually specifically Christian understanding, was the thing that allowed him to keep his logic and his reason and to find a place for imagination and joy and longing and reason itself. I wanted to stop. A few more things I could say, but I think we promised questions, and so I think that's probably a better use about time. Thank you very much for listening, and I think we've got about 10 minutes for questions and comments if you have them to make. Yes?
So who was instrumental in Lewis's conversion?
The question is, who was instrumental in Lewis's conversion? It's an interesting conversion story because he had a massive capacity to have an interior life in a way that I don't. Like, I feel like I might have had some of those joy experiences, but I wouldn't be able to tell you specifically where they were or what they felt like, or that it was a currant tree and that it was in bloom and so on. He had this massive interior world, and that seems to have played out in his conversion, that he wasn't evangelized by a clergyman in those days. He didn't go to a cracking great church service or anything like that. It was really him finding that path himself in his own reading and thinking, with this friendship group of Tolkien and Barfield and so on. But it had that very, as you read it, that very kind of Oxbridge feel to it, where they would never kind of straight out say, you know, Lewis, can I pray with you that you'd come to know the Lord? It was just suggestion and intuition and little 3 a.m. talks over beer and pipes and so on. Yeah. So as you know, in the account there, he kneels down and admits that God is God in his room in Magdalen, and he converts to faith in Christ in particular in a car on a way, or a there's some historical debate, a car or a the side of a motorbike on the way to a zoo. Yeah. His contemporaries, how did his contemporaries take his conversion? Quite badly, apart from that immediate circle of the Inklings who were like right into it. But he remained what I think we would probably call a junior tutor or a junior lecturer in Oxford for his whole career there. In the senior common rooms of Magdalen and so on, people really really did not like him, partly because of his personality. Like he wasn't backward. Like once he became a Christian, he went for it, and partly some cultural things. Like it was kind of not proper in the Edwardian era to publish popular material if you're an Oxford don. And suddenly his Screwtape Letters is like a hit and he becomes famous, and then he broadcasts In Mere Christianity during the war, and that was just seen as a bit kind of tarty. a bit like Slavoj Žižek, like that kind of, there he is, you can find him on YouTube. And so that was part of it. But also, to be fair, and non-Christian commentators say this, just the sheer fact of becoming a Christian, where it felt like the intellectual tide was away from it, just marked him out as kind of a lightweight. So he got he was kind of somewhat vindicated by Cambridge in his last 5 years, where he was given a professorship for the first time in medieval literature, which is a whole other story, because that's where Leavis is. He's great. Anyway, yeah. He certainly did... suffer in a kind of first world way, the slings and arrows of a hostile common room. Yeah.
You mentioned at the start how like some people who are converts of anything particular can have that kind of transient jump in and then jump out the next thing. It's like a snapshot into how he stayed there and like what kept him there rather than moving on.
Great question. Yeah. So how did Lewis not only become a Christian but stay a Christian? I think one of the advantages of becoming a Christian in your 30s, there's almost no advantages to being in your 30s, but one of them is that you kind of creep up on it slowly. So I guess he wasn't caught up in a particular moment. He was able to build a pretty secure foundation to that conversion. But he had some real trouble. So that there was one where it was more a personal thing, where he kind of basically won every debate he was in. But then there was an Australian female philosopher at Oxford whose name escapes me, who also was a Christian, a Catholic Christian, but pointed out had a debate with him at the Socratic Society and kind of nailed him, found something that was really wrong in his logic. And after that point, he kind of stopped publishing apologetic material, more or less, and published a subsequent thing which addressed her thing, but he seemed to be quite bruised by that. And then started writing Narnia, which I guess someone like Pullman would say that's what you do. If you lose the debate, you go and make up a whole other world. But the other thing, the other point of his life, which we didn't get to because it wasn't relevant, but he has a very unusual marriage to a Jewish Christian convert late in life, and they're together for a few years. Then she dies of cancer. And he writes this. You might be aware there's a book called The Problem of Pain, which is kind of a good book. Like you read it and you think that's a B+ in terms of some reasoning. There's a few bits that are where he skips the raising and stuff. But if you read it and you haven't really suffered, you think he nails it. If you read it and you have suffered, you think, this is kind of cold. This is a very cerebral book. And then at the end of his life, he writes A Grief Observed, which is the most devastating personal account of grief that, you know, one of the top three in the Western canon. It is the most heart-wrenching book, and it accounts for doubt, and he talks about you scream to God and the door is slammed in your face. It's the most... It's an incredible book. And in some ways, I think you need Problem of Pain, and but you also need A Grief Observed. And I think that his life, I think his Christian faith was shaped by that event as well. So he came through that a Christian, but I think in some ways a Christian with a slightly better instinct, that the problem of pain isn't ultimately in the Christian tradition an intellectual problem to be solved, but a radical evil to be overcome. And I think in some ways I think he was more Christian in that rawness than he was in the thing. I think we've got time for one more question, and there was another hand. He did. So his relationship, at Oxford, every place has got a chapel, and all the colleges have got a chapel. And one of the ways the whispers started going around Magdalen. So you can imagine this is almost a perfect comparison. Imagine that you started to see Richard Dawkins attending chapel, and that's what it was. And suddenly this famously atheist guy, he's famous in Oxford. He wasn't famous in England yet. But then they started seeing him at chapel, and he it was kind of, again, that kind of Edwardian English thing where you didn't pry into people's private affairs, but you're kind of like, he started going there. And then eventually so he goes to chapel, but doesn't feel he can participate in Holy Communion, and it's only after that ride to the zoo that he eventually receives the sacrament, and that for him is some kind of moment of clarity. So he did. He kind of shuffled off to church. He hated it when people changed stuff, like new liturgies were getting introduced, and he'd like roll his eyes about. He just wanted it to be exactly the same as it was. And he went to Greece later in life and attended a Eastern Orthodox liturgy, and he really liked it. And if you talk to Eastern Orthodox people, they like Lewis, and they very much like that. He liked their liturgy because he wrote a little letter to a friend saying. In the Greek, is anyone here Orthodox? In the Orthodox liturgy, he said, it seems that the participants do whatever they want. Some of them are sitting, some of them are standing, some of them are walking in and out. He said, it's much to be preferred to our Anglican tradition. so he's kind of a big fan of that. But yeah, so he had a fairly... he's a regular churchgoer, and that was part of the way he indicated himself. He also was involved in founding a thing called the Socratic Society, which is where Christian issues were debated and so on. That was his kind of formal and kind of institutional contribution to Oxford. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
Thanks, Rory. Well, there's supper outside, and there's also going to be a bookstore, but apart from that... this kind of brings the formal part of the lecture to a close. This lecture is brought to you by the UWA Christian Union. We have meetings on Tuesdays at 1 o'clock at Social Sciences Lecture Theatre. That's all from me. Have a good night. Thanks.